There's less than 2 months for the primary. Today, we meet another candidate running for governor. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Chris King is a businessman, not a politician, but he wants to be governor. Currently, he's behind Philip Levine and Gwen Graham in different polls. Today, he joins us to share his thoughts on how he would run the state. Plus, sea turtle populations are shrinking. There are efforts to help protect the sea creatures, but climate change, development, and poachers are growing challenges. We'll learn how you can help. And some people want to be buried in cemeteries. Others want to have their ashes scattered in unique locales. What about having your remains placed in a mausoleum underwater? There's a large one built off the coast of Key Biscayne. We're going to talk with the artist behind the artificial reef. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, we are 8 weeks away from the primaries. Currently, there are five major candidates in the Democratic Party running for governor. The latest polls show that Philip Levine is in the lead with Gwen Graham not far behind, followed by Chris King, Andrew Gillum, and Jeff Green. Well, our next guest is Orlando businessman Chris King. He is the founder of Elevation Financial Group, and he joins us from the studios of sister station WMFE in Orlando. Welcome to Sundial, Mr. King.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Lewis.
And if you have a question for Mr. King, call in at 800-743-9576, or you can find us on Twitter or Facebook, WLRN Sundial. Again, that's 800-743-9576. Mr. King, why are you running for governor?
Well, Lewis, you know, I have been very dissatisfied with the state of politics in the state of Florida and the Democratic Party. And so most people who followed my race and what's given me lift is I have been the candidate to stand up to conventional politics and to bring fresh ideas both to the Democratic Party but to the political debate in Florida. And I have been so proud as we get to 8 weeks before the primary that we have been leading the debate on the major issues of the day. And I think I've demonstrated, whether it's affordable housing or free community college and trade school or taking on the sugar industry, that my candidacy has been one that's brought new ideas and stood up to some very powerful political interests.
So depending on which poll you read, you are climbing, but you're still behind Philip Levine and Gwen Graham. So with 8 weeks left, what's the strategy?
That's right. You know, I've been very encouraged. I'm just coming off of a long weekend in South Florida where I spoke 10 or 12 times throughout South Florida. And I'm very encouraged that our numbers have been climbing pretty dramatically in markets across the state over the last 2 months. But with 8 weeks to go, we've got to make up some territory on the front runner. And the way I do that, I believe, is making sure we get our message and my story in front of as many people as possible so that they understand that my candidacy is one that is not just trying to suggest that victory is about winning, but it's also about being transformative with our politics. And I think that's what voters in 2018 are looking for. They're looking for candidates who are authentically progressive, but also are creative and have the ideas that address some of Florida's biggest problems.
Now, you've stated in other interviews that you don't have the money that Levine or Jeff Green has. So how important is it? How important is your ability to buy that ad space and build, you know, a fully fledged campaign?
Well, it's certainly a huge part of it. I mean, we have been we've been up on many markets throughout the state, and this next month you'll see us in a lot of additional markets. And so we've had the ability and will have the ability to communicate our message. But look, it's daunting when you're running against a billionaire or someone with the resources of one like that. But my belief, my optimism, my idealism in the people of Florida and in Democrats is the winner is going to be somebody who captures the imagination and has answers to the biggest problems of Florida. Take affordable housing. If I wasn't in this race, this issue would not be being talked about. And yet, in South Florida, it is, I would argue, one of the number one economic challenges. Families across South Florida are often paying 40 or 50 or 60% of their income in rent or mortgage. They're often having to drive an hour and a half between the job and their home or their apartment. I think that's wrong. And at the very time that we've had that issue, these last 20 years, as it's gotten worse and worse and worse, our leaders in Tallahassee have been raiding or taking from the Affordable Housing Trust Fund to the tune of almost $2 billion, which has been an attack on working families. I've been so proud, Lewis, that my campaign has said, we're going to stop that. We're going to fix this issue, and we're going to stand behind working families across the state of Florida.
The number again is 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. You can always find us on Twitter or Facebook. Just go to WLRN Sundial. You could post your question there. Let's hit some of the big issues. And, Mr. King, I want to start with gun control because that did take center stage this past legislative session. After the Parkland shooting, we've seen students now, they're on a tour of the state to get the vote out, and they're challenging the NRA. The governor signed gun legislation going against the NRA. They're now suing the state, the NRA is. You've come up with this idea called Every Kid Fund. What is that?
That's right. So, you know, I am from Orlando. So the Pulse nightclub tragedy was obviously a major inspiration for me in informing and formulating my gun safety policies early in my campaign. And then, of course, the students of Parkland, I met a number of them even this weekend down in South Florida, have been enormously courageous and impactful in changing the debate across the state of Florida. I often say we're standing on their shoulders when it comes to making these arguments. You know, I have been so proud that my campaign has introduced what's been called the most ambitious policy to date when it comes to addressing gun safety in Florida. Now, first, I'm for a ban on assault weapons. I'm for universal background checks and a lot of the things that traditional Democrats are now talking about. But where I go one step forward or further is what I call the Every Kid Fund for Gun Violence Prevention, which I rolled out last month, which would be a dedicated revenue source which would invest in the very best programs, initiatives, and technologies to prevent everyday and mass tragedy gun violence. And it would do that by taking sales tax revenues from firearms and ammunition, and it would add an additional 6% safety fee, or what's been called a bullet tax, to ammunition, to create a new fund that would seek to do these things. I'm the only candidate with this idea and approach. And I tell you, Lewis, you know, what has been my continual inspiration is when I'm traveling around the state. I was in Jacksonville a couple weeks ago at a gun safety speech. And the way moms and dads who have suffered from gun violence, they come up to me and they often have a picture of their child on their shirt, on a button. And they continuously remind me the importance of what I'm fighting for and what we're doing, because they know how hard and the suffering that families across this state feel from losing children to gun violence.
Do you think the state should have a ban on weapons like the AR-15, a weapon that was used in the Parkland shooting?
I do. And, you know, I said that in my very first speech for governor over a year ago, a ban on assault weapons. You know, the types of weapons that were used in Parkland and in Pulse and in other major tragedies across the United States, you know, these weapons have been constructed for the killing fields. They have been designed to inflict as much damage as humanly possible on the killing fields. And I often tell crowds when I'm speaking in schools or in colleges or in community centers across the state of Florida, one bad person with a very powerful AR-15 could come into this room and take us all out very, very quickly before we could do anything to respond. And I just don't think that is the way we want to move forward in the state of Florida.
Moving forward to, I want to come back to affordable housing, which is something you had mentioned in your opening statement. And look, this is a statewide issue, but as you know, really big challenge here in South Florida. As governor, explain to us how you would be able to help our community here with the issue of affordable housing. What would you do?
A great question. Dramatically. You know, I often say I want to be the nation's most innovative governor when it comes to housing issues. I say it's our number one economic challenge. And, you know, what I have tried to explain to folks across Florida is the last Democratic governor, Lawton Childs, had a real vision of how we got this right and didn't mess it up. And in the early 90s, he established something called the Sadowski Housing Trust Fund. And it was simply a really great public-private partnership because he saw the state of Florida changing. He saw it growing. He saw more and more people coming here. And he was concerned that families would be priced out of the market. And so he created a fund that would assist or help build affordable housing for teachers and seniors and working families all across the state of Florida. The problem is that beginning in the early 2000s, Jeb Bush and future Republican governors began to take money from that fund, and it became a very, very significant problem. And so, Lewis, what I have pledged is simply by winning, because I will have enough veto-proof protections in the legislature, simply by winning, I will have the ability to invest nearly $1 billion in public and private money in all sorts of housing programs. And that would be felt in Miami-Dade County in a number of ways, from first-time home ownership to housing for seniors. And I think that could be a game changer for your area.
We are talking with Chris King. He is one of the five Democratic gubernatorial candidates. Right now, the primary's barely 8 weeks away. What has he got to do to move up in the polls? He is in third right now, depending on which poll you're looking at. We're going to continue this conversation and take some of your calls. Again, the number is 800-743-9576. What question do you have for Mr. King as he's running for governor? What do you expect from him? 800-743-9576. We'll continue this conversation in just a moment. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Lewis Hernandez, and our guest today is Chris King, the Orlando businessman, one of the five Democratic candidates in the gubernatorial race. Again, the primaries are coming up August 28th. All right, Mr. King, before I go to the phones, we're talking about affordable housing. We hit on gun control. One other thing I wanted to ask you about, too, is you brought up in the debates, you brought up the sugar industry. That wasn't really a topic until you started talking about it. And so I'm just, what is your fight with the sugar industry?
That's right. What I have argued is that if you care about rising seas and climate change, clean water, or Everglades restoration, a candidate who wants to be the next Democratic governor of Florida has to have the political courage to acknowledge that one industry, the sugar industry, has often stood in the way of environmental progress in the state of Florida. And I have argued, I think successfully, that they currently have a vice grip on our politics in this state. And, I was the first candidate in a generation that came out and said, I'm not going to take money from the sugar industry, and I'm not going to be beholden when it comes to our environment. And since then, several of the other major Democratic candidates have followed, my lead. And so I would argue, as we look out at the state of affairs in Florida today environmentally, and we look at, for instance, the discharges from Lake Okeechobee right now that are impacting the east or western coasts of the state of Florida, an issue of great economic and environmental importance. These are issues that have been exacerbated by Big Sugar's influence in not allowing us to get water south. And, one of my real concerns for South Florida, for Miami-Dade and Broward and the millions of people who live there, is their future access to water and rising seas. And without moving water south, without moving clean water south and replenishing the Everglades and Florida Bay, this is currently the best bulwark we have to rising seas and to access to clean water. And my belief is the sugar industry has stood in the way of that.
So what is the strategy, though? I mean, what is it you're trying to, you're picking a fight with them. Is it an all-out fight you want with them? Or, what do you intend to do on dealing, because you bring up the algae blooms, that was another question I have for you, is we're seeing that's another issue that could be a big killer for us this summer. But, they're not the only one to blame for that. But what is your strategy in taking on the sugar industry and agriculture in general? Because they are an important part of our economy.
They are an important part of our economy. And I have said from day one, my goal or objective was not to vilify a company or an industry. And I certainly am not in any way desiring to see an end to the sugar industry. My problem is the fact that they have enormous influence over both the Democratic and Republican parties. Look, I just gave a speech, an annual Democratic convention down in Broward this weekend. And, you know, Sugar was well represented at that speech as one of the key sponsors. And what I have, I think, accurately and demonstrated to folks across Florida is that their influence has created a situation where they're really driving what we do and what we don't do. So, for instance, I want to see a reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee that's storing and cleaning water and getting it south. They've stood in the way of that in a pretty major way. I want to see an end to these discharges that create toxic-like environments in estuaries east and west in Florida. And, you know, I even, Lewis, this was an interesting thing, and I think gives a real sense of the difference in my candidacy. I traveled to Belglade, which, of course, is south of Lake Okeechobee, just about a week and a half ago. And I was there to really better understand what's called sugarcane or pre-harvest sugarcane burning. And my concern was, you know, we have a practice now in the state of Florida where for almost 6 or 7 months a year, 6 or 7 days a week, it snows south of Lake Okeechobee black ash. We essentially, as part of our pre-harvest burning, set our towns on fire and our sugarcane on fire. And I was there to better understand how those communities of color, deeply impoverished, have been affected from a public health standpoint. I think those are the questions I'm asking. I'd love to see a good and strong and healthy sugar industry, but not at the expense of Florida's environment or its people. I'm the only one in this race as a Democrat or a Republican making that case. And I think that's the only way we're going to see progress on the environment.
All right. I want to get to the phones now and get a couple of folks in here. I'm going to start with Michael in Fort Lauderdale. Michael, thanks for your patience. What's your question for Chris King?
I wanted to ask him that if and when he wins the primary, what are his plans to win in November against the Republican?
All right, Michael, thank you for the call. Mr. King, if you win the primary, well, first, I mean, did you watch the debate last week between DeSantis and Putnam?
Yes, I was speaking that same night, so I've watched clips and I've read about it. And I can tell you, and I appreciate Michael's question, you know, I think I've studied these candidates on the Republican side about as well as anybody. And I've argued for a long time now that I believe I am wired, I am built to beat the likes of someone like Adam Putnam or Ron DeSantis. You know, they will be, and I've told our Democrats, they will be tough, disciplined, well-funded candidates. I just believe they're wrong on all the major issues of the day. And I think my ability, if folks watched me in Democratic debates, I can, I think, winsomely and clearly lay out a vision for Florida that's very, very different. And, you know, take some of the issues we've just talked about, and let's say it's Adam Putnam. You know, Adam Putnam has never talked about affordable housing. He's been up there while they've been raiding the Affordable Housing Trust Fund. You know, Adam Putnam would oppose an expansion of Medicaid, which would cover upwards of 800,000 to a million people with access to a doctor who knows their name. You know, Adam Putnam has taken about more money from the sugar industry than any politician in modern times. I, of course, contrast with him beautifully on that issue. Adam Putnam has called himself a proud NRA. Vicious gun safety policies in Florida.
All right. I want to take one more call here real quickly. I'm going to Ray, I believe it is, that I have here in Miami. Ray, welcome to the program.
Yes. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question. I work for the Department of Transportation for the state of Florida, and I was wondering, I heard that the budget was like $4 billion. And I have a little something that Mr. Scott and his administration didn't do for us, the state of Florida employees, that there's no raises and there's no bonuses. With such a large budget, a fraction of that cannot go and help out those that are the ones that are putting all these different projects together and that are working hard for the state of Florida. How would you handle that, Mr. King? How would you take care of us as state of Florida employees?
Ray, thank you for the call. Appreciate it.
Ray, thank you for the call and for your work. I believe you said with the Department of Transportation, FDOT.
Yes.
First and foremost, I would argue across the board for people like Ray and state and local employees across the state of Florida. Teachers are another wonderful example. Corrections officers in our state jail and prison system. This has not been an administration or a Republican Party that I would argue values the work of working men and women who are working in our public institutions. And I think that has contributed to making them not work as effectively, whether we're talking about FDOT or our prison system. And so one of the things I've suggested is this is an economy that is not fair to a lot of folks. It works very well for the wealthy and well-connected, but not everybody else. I would be looking for ways to invest in state, local employees that contribute so much to the state of Florida. And indeed, there are so many examples where there has not been cost of living adjustments or raises. And that's something that this next governor would have to take very seriously and begin to bake into our budgets.
Let me finish with this, Mr. King, and actually I'm going to go to a Facebook question. But this comes back to what qualifies you, because you're not a politician. And you boast about that you're the businessman. But we get a question from Chris Olson on Facebook, basically asking the same thing I wanted to ask, which is, you know, Mr. King, why would we want another candidate who claims he's not a normal politician? We do have one in the White House.
Yes. And I share nothing in common with that politician in the White House. I am a progressive. I am a lifelong Democrat. I'm somebody who has done work, considerable work in affordable housing and sending Title I students to college, working on environmental progress. You know, what I've argued, though, in Florida is that the Democratic Party has been good at losing for the last two decades. It has been conventional politics, status quo politics, year after year after year. And we've lost this election five straight times. I believe if folks tune in to the debates, if they read about our story, what they will see is this newcomer who is leading the career politicians in big ideas, in attention to detail. I mean, I'm running against candidates that don't know the size of the education budget in Florida. And I have demonstrated, I think, a studious attention to detail and a commitment to excellence in everything I do. That's what folks who vote for Chris King would be getting in the next Democratic governor.
He is Chris King, one of the five Democratic gubernatorial candidates. Again, the primary is coming up in 8 weeks. Mr. King joining us from the studios of WMFE in Orlando. Mr. King, thank you so much. I appreciate your time today.
Love being here. Thank you, Lewis.
All right, still to come, sea turtle populations currently facing a crisis. What can you do about it? That's all coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, six of the seven sea turtle species in the world are considered endangered. A confluence of factors from human poaching of eggs to bayfront lighting and the changing climate have led to the precipitous decline of the animal. Researchers and volunteer organizations have been scrambling to preserve the remaining sea turtle population. Fort Lauderdale is in many ways on the front lines of that battle. The nonprofit organization Sea Turtle Oversight Protection estimates they've saved 180,000 turtles since 2007, but they say that's just a drop in the bucket. Well, the newest issue of Fort Lauderdale Magazine dives deep into the crisis facing sea turtles. It was written by journalist Ryan Pfeffer, who joins us in studio now. Ryan, such a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Lewis. Happy to be here.
Also joining us, because in that article, there are some amazing photographs of sea turtles, and you can see them, by the way, on our social media. Just look up WLRN Sundial. And it's from South Florida-based photographer Ben Hicks, who joins us from Michigan via Skype. Ben, it's such a pleasure.
How are you doing? Good to be on the show.
Great to have you. Ryan, let me start with you. Your story examines the various threats facing the sea turtle population in Fort Lauderdale, but let's begin by looking at trash in the ocean. In what ways has it proven incredibly dangerous for sea turtles?
In so many ways, Lewis. And one immediate way is that sea turtles eat jellyfish. It's very tasty to them. And when you put a plastic bag in water, if you want to do an experiment at home, put one in your bathtub, it looks remarkably like a jellyfish. So sea turtles will eat them. I remember seeing a viral photo not too long ago of a plastic straw stuck in a sea turtle's nose. So, you know, we hear about plastic pollution being so harmful to just about everything in the ocean. And sea turtles are certainly one of the species that suffer from this. And it's one of the reasons why we have Ben on the phone with us right now, because he took a very interesting photo that I talked about in my story.
Yeah, this photo, by the way, it went viral. Ben, you have this photo of a turtle that is swimming up to a plastic bag. How did you capture that moment? Take us there.
I'm out in the water quite often. I've been shooting sea turtles for almost 10 years out in the wild. And during that entire time, I have yet to come across this turtle actually attempting to eat a piece of plastic. And obviously, in the moment, it was a lot of emotions coming from me, but also trying to capture the image and then immediately take the bag away from the opportunity of the turtle to eat it. It was quite an experience, and it leads to why I'm talking to you guys today. The impact of what we have on sea turtles and as many other animals in the ocean, with all the ocean plastic surrounding where we live.
And Ben, something else to that is again the fact that here you are, and you see this moment, and of course as a photographer I can imagine, well, you got to capture this. Is a powerful image. But at the same time, you want to protect that turtle.
Yeah, you're correct. Yep, it is a very powerful image that I knew once I captured it, it would definitely it would be another way for me to use my images as a voice to communicate the issues that are going on around the world, not just in South Florida, but everywhere I travel. There's plastic, and it always ends up in the ocean.
Ryan, aside from the plastic bag, something else too you point out, humans have targeted sea turtles as a source of protein. Explain their value in some Latin American cultures.
Well, sea turtle eggs aren't a totally uncommon part of some diets in South America and the Caribbean. If you're a hungry person and you have 100 to 120 eggs sitting there on the beach, it's a hard source of protein to pass up. What a lot of people don't know is just how endangered and threatened these species are. So a lot of it is about awareness, but it definitely happens here in South Florida. Last year, two Palm Beach men were arrested for digging up hundreds of eggs. Authorities estimated they could have got a little over $2,000 for them on the black market.
$2,000 for?
I think it was about 400 eggs. That's a couple nests worth. And they were sentenced to 7 months in prison. So this is certainly an issue that Florida Fish and Wildlife in the state of Florida takes very seriously. But it happens. Aside from people, raccoons will actually also dig them up. For the story, I spoke to Joe Satraki, who is over at the Museum of Discovery and Science and who helps lead these nightly turtle walks that are going on right now, actually. And if you can get in, you should definitely try and go. They're very cool. But he told me on two separate occasions on the beach at night, he has seen people with buckets trying to dig them up. So it's a hard crime to prosecute, too, because it happens at night and there's not a huge police presence on the beach. And these nests are everywhere. There's over 100,000 of them in the state of Florida. So it definitely happens.
Ben, in your travels and photographing sea turtles, have you seen the egg hunters out there?
I haven't personally, but I was just in Panama about 3 weeks ago with the Sea Turtle Conservancy, and we were tagging leatherback sea turtles, and it's a real problem there for the indigenous people that still harvest the eggs and the turtles, as well as the shells. And just like Ryan was mentioning, it's a problem that they've lived for thousands of years or hundreds of years harvesting those eggs and those turtles. And as far as people stealing them where we live, it's a shame that they're being greedy. But it's a problem that continues to persist. I haven't personally run into it myself, though.
Yeah. Again, we're talking with journalist Ryan Pfeffer from Fort Lauderdale. He has a piece in Fort Lauderdale Magazine, recently wrote about the challenges that sea turtle populations are facing. And we've also been talking with South Florida-based photographer Ben Hicks, who's taken some amazing photos for that story. We're going to let him go, though, because we got a bad connection. Again, he was joining us in Michigan via Skype, and it's just coming in and out. So if we can't reconnect, then we'll just try to get him. We're going to bring him back in the studio at some point. But you've got to check out these photos. They are stunning photos. We have them on our social media. Again, look up WLRN Sundial. Really just some of the best stuff I've ever seen. But you also see, you know, because we were talking, Ryan, about one of those photographs, the photograph that went viral, the one about where the sea turtle was swimming up to a plastic bag, thinking it was a jellyfish. This is one of the big problems, of course, that we see out there. You know what? I mean, what sparked, Ryan, what sparked this idea to write this story? We've always known the issues with sea turtles and the challenges they face.
Well, it was an assignment from my editor, I guess is the simple question to that. But
that's always a good one.
I was born and raised in Fort Lauderdale. And, you know, I always knew sea turtles were out there. They're kind of like this boogeyman. Yeah, they're out there in the sea somewhere. You see them on license plates and on stickers and T-shirts, and they crawl up to the shore in the middle of the night, and you never really see them. So I had never considered them too deeply, even as a native South Floridian. And then in the course of writing the story, I realized just how critical South Florida is as a habitat for these loggerhead turtles and green turtles specifically. I mean, we are crucial to the species survival down here. And a lot's happening. And I mean, I throughout this process of writing the story, I felt a pretty deep shame of having never known some of these seemingly obvious and kind of shocking facts about sea turtles.
And, you know, what we talked about, obviously hunting for the eggs. We talked about, you know, some of the other issues like the trash that's out in the oceans. Another one, though, too, is light. This is one that many of us may know because I grew up in Florida, so I know this one, the issue with lights. And so real quickly, remind us, what is the issue with the shining of the bright lights, especially from A1A onto the beachfront, and how that is very damaging to sea turtle nesting?
Yeah. So when sea turtles hatch, their instinct tells them to crawl towards the brightest spot they can find. Traditionally, in nature, that is the moon and the stars reflecting off the water. As these beachfront cities continue to, you know, develop immensely with bright lights and bars and restaurants and hotels, turtles hatch out of their nest and they look around and they see a bright light, but it's not the water. They're heading towards the street. So this is a really big problem. In Broward County specifically, in the year 2000, it basically told all the cities to develop their own turtle lighting ordinances that they're in charge of regulating and enforcing. And they've done that. So each city is a little different in how they regulate and enforce their sea turtle lighting. But there are laws in place, but there is serious debate to the effectiveness of those laws because disorientation is still a really big problem. And turtles are getting crushed and crawling into the street quite a bit.
But you say for the most part, the cities are doing a good job of enforcing these rules.
I wouldn't say that. This story that I wrote specifically focuses on Fort Lauderdale, and there is a lot of criticism lobbied against Fort Lauderdale that, yes, they do have these laws in place. Properties can get fined hundreds of dollars. However, there is no enforcement. At least that's what a lot of the criticism from activism groups in Fort Lauderdale is saying. And I looked into this and I contacted one of the code enforcement supervisors in Fort Lauderdale just to basically try and find out who is getting fined. Are they fining people? How does their enforcement system work? They responded back to me. They told me they'd work with the public information officer to get me that information. And then they failed to do so. And I followed up again and again, and they failed to do it to get back to me at all. So they're not doing themselves any favors in this criticism. But yeah, specifically against Fort Lauderdale, people say that the laws are in place, but there's absolutely no enforcement. It's very toothless, if there is any.
And so really, I mean, what more could, you know, any of these groups that are trying to fight and protect the sea turtles, what more that can they do in that case? I mean, is it a matter of knocking on doors? Hey, come on.
Yeah, you know what it is? I talked to Doug Young from the South Florida Audubon Society, and I asked him, you know, is this a problem of people just not caring, saying screw the sea turtles? Or is this a problem of awareness, people not just knowing? And he said more often it's a problem of awareness. Once we tell them what they can do and how easy these fixes are, they tend to cooperate. So yeah, a lot of it's about awareness, about keep hammering, you know, with these facts, information, and telling people what they can do.
So sea turtles, you know, face a significant challenge because of the egg survival rate and the expanding heat in the sand. Now we're going to get to issues of climate change and so forth. Explain how temperatures impact the gender of the turtle.
Yeah, so the gender of the turtle is determined by the temperature of the nest. The hotter the nest, the more likely it is to produce females. The colder the nest, the more likely it is to produce males. And a neat turtle trick to remember this is hot chicks, cool dudes. That's what turtle people like to say. So, it's not news to anyone in South Florida. We have been having some brutally hot summers lately. Last July was the hottest July in Miami recorded history. It was the sixth hottest July in Fort Lauderdale recorded history. So the natural question emerges, you know, what does that mean for these nests? And there is a professor at FAU named Jeanette Weineken who has been leading some research into this since 2002. And she recently published a study that took where basically she went to different nests and took samples from those nests and in effort to see, you know, how many males are we getting, how many females are we getting. And so she recently published a study with data from 2010 to 2013. For the first 3 years of that study, that she took samples from South Florida nests, she didn't find a single male turtle. In the last year, she found a few samples of female turtles. But the rest of the year, the hotter portion of the year, it was all females. And she's continued to do this research since that study. And she did an interview with the Sun Sentinel in January where she told them in the last 3 years, she hasn't found a single male turtle.
So really, what in the world could we do about that? I mean, that's, I understand turning off the lights. I understand trying to keep poachers away, but how do we deal with that issue?
You know, they're just figuring this out because they don't, she's been measuring the status since 2002. So there's not a lot, you know, scientists like big decades worth of data so they can determine and see how natural and how much of a cause for alarm certain things are. So they don't have that yet. They're very concerned. I mean, obviously, a lot of it is combating climate change and trying to get these temperatures down and trying to get our summers at a more stable, even natural trajectory. I guess, hypothetically, you could take the eggs out of the nest, relocate them, and have a more controlled temperature environment for them. But there are over 100,000 nests in the state of Florida. We just don't have the manpower to do that effectively. So it's a big, scary thing that certainly is on the radar for everyone in the scientific community.
What's the strategy in protecting sea turtle populations? I mean, are we talking about really mostly volunteers, or is it just a small group of people?
It's a mixture of volunteers and dedicated scientists. So Nova Southeastern University actually patrols the beaches for Broward County at 5 a.m. to however long it takes every single day of nesting season. They are only not out there if there's a hurricane. And they're looking for nests, so they're keeping track and monitoring tightly this data. And there's also an impressive force of volunteers who, in South Florida, in Fort Lauderdale specifically, go out every night of nesting season, wait till those nests hatch, and grab any turtle they can find that's going in the opposite direction towards the street and put them in buckets and redirect them towards the water.
If people want to get involved, is it easy? If somebody wants to volunteer and help out?
Sure. These organizations are very open to having volunteers. You can look them up. The South Florida Audubon Society does a lot of great work. STOP, the Sea Turtle Oversight and Protection group in Fort Lauderdale, does a lot of great work too. Also, if you got a chance, stop by the Carpenter House in Hollywood. That's where Nova Southeastern's Marine Department has their headquarters, and they have a sea turtle over there named Captain. She has buoyancy issues. Her butt floats. She was hit by a boat, so that's why she can't go back into the wild, but she's incredibly charming and sassy, and it's really neat to see one in person. And they've got a lot of cool demonstrations over there that kind of teach you a little more about sea turtle lighting and other awesome sea turtle facts.
Ryan Pfeffer, again, he's got a piece in Fort Lauderdale Magazine on the challenges that sea turtles face. Those populations are shrinking. There are a lot of challenges that they're facing, but there's a lot that we might be able to do as well. We also heard from photographer Ben Hicks, because some of his photographs, again, his photographs are in that piece. You got to check them out. We have them on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Just fantastic photographs. Ryan, it's such a pleasure, man. Thank you so much.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
All right, still to come, how would you feel about having your remains buried under the sea, talking about the ocean? All right, well, more on that coming up on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. About 40 feet underwater off the coast of Key Biscayne lies the Neptune Memorial Reef. The man-made reef serves as a popular dive destination, an art piece as well, and an alternative to cemetery burial. It's home to 1,500 cremation placements, and today the mausoleum is launching a new expansion for it. The expansion will have the space to memorialize more than 250,000 individuals and cover 16 acres of the ocean floor. Now, the idea for the architectural structure of the artificial reef came from the sculpture artist Kim Brandel. He was inspired by the lost city of Atlantis and added decorative arches, columns, and memorial sculptures made out of cremated remains mixed within the cement. Randall, the designer of the Neptune Memorial Reef, says this is the first mausoleum project that he's worked on, and he joins us via Skype to tell us about the reef's architectural elements and its creation. Kim, such a pleasure. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. Nice to be here.
How would you describe to someone who probably may not ever go scuba diving and go underwater to see it, the Neptune Memorial Reef?
Well, it was designed kind of loosely around Atlantis. That's what we originally had called it. And so there's columns, there's the first phase we did was a foyer to the 16-acre city. And, it has a lot of, structures. And it's just a fabulous diving site. And that's kind of number one. And then number two, like you mentioned, there are placements for cremated remains.
Did you originally think of this as a memorial, or did it start as something else?
Well, actually, it was a buddy of mine who came up with the idea about, doing some kind of memorial. And then he contacted me to design it and build it, because I've been a metal sculptor for 42 years now. And I've done all kinds of large projects and things, so he knew I could take care of it. But then we want to, it turned into Atlantis. And then we found out took us a couple of years, but we actually got a permit from the Army Corps of Engineers to have 16 acres, which was all nothing but sand. No fish there, no growth or anything. And because of that, because it was just sand and about 8-9 feet deep of sand, we could build our structures there.
And I'm curious as to how you got that particular plot of land under the sea. Is it something you could choose, or who are you asking for permission to have that space?
Well, the Army Corps of Engineers, there is a designated area to put down reefs. I believe it's maybe a mile wide and quite a few miles long. Now, most of what they've put down are some old ships there. Now, those are down in 120 feet. So that's very, very deep. And the reason for that is because they can sink them, and hurricanes really won't move them much. So we were really the first group to come up with marine engineering that would pretty much guarantee that these structures would not move. So, it took us a couple of years to go through all the processes and meet with all the different organizations that had something to say about it, and, make sure that everybody was okay with the project. And then we got the permit. And this little area was part of that main area. But it was because there was no reefs or anything there that we got that site.
So I'd imagine with any artist, it's always interesting to talk about how you gather your materials and plan and prepare. But now you have this extra challenge. You're creating this amazing site underwater. So, what were some of the challenges as you're putting this together? And talk a little bit about the design, because you have these beautiful columns and sculptures. You create this, this whole setting underwater. It is a beautiful dive site.
Yes, thanks. First of all, it was just a group of friends and family and, that put money together to get the first several columns and some lions and gates I made, and because nobody really believed that we could do it. They just said, "Nah, you don't have 16 acres out there." And so finally we got enough money up to dump, just dump off of a barge these different pieces. Then we had kind of proof that we can do it. So then we actually went around and we went to the Neptune Society, which was the biggest provider for cremated remains, you know, placements and this and that, and came in and brought those in as partners. So then we had to design, you know, the structures, of course, so they had holes and crevices, and some of them, you know, I made them to have areas for grouper to go into and lobsters, and you know, so that was all a factor in regards to it.
This is a memorial, yep. And one of the things I found fascinating, and I want to ask about, if somebody wants to have their remains there, there's a process. And correct. it's not just that, you know, you take the little canister of ashes. There's a process. What is that process?
Well, first of all, the law is that you can't put just cremated remains down, because they could wash out, let's say, possibly. So the remains are mixed with cement in a mold. Now, some of these molds are cylinders, which then slide down inside the columns, and then on the outside there's a bronze plaque with your name and dates, or, you know, whatever you want to put. There's special areas that you can put the placements, and then there's a door that goes over it, which is cement. So, you know, you pick the spot that you might like, and you know, what we thought, what a good saying would be, is it's life after death, because what you're doing by paying for a placement, that money goes towards building the reef, which of course is going to produce all kinds of life.
This is something else too that's interesting about, compared to other, I guess, burial sites, is reefs are going to grow over it. Coral is going to grow over it. So doesn't the coral just cover up the plaques? And you actually talked about the fact that the coral has covered up some of the artwork that you designed.
Well, that is correct. Now, you know, when I designed this, I wanted it to be not like Roman or Greek columns. So I made them a little more contemporary, a little more fun, a little more sculptural, let's say. And because the pictures and videos in the first, you know, the first people, the people seeing it for the first time would see all these wonderful detailed structures, not to mislead them, but just give them, you know, the look of this place. Now, years and years later, most of the details are, like you mentioned, are all gone, but you still see the columns and the lintels and the seating areas and the different type of sculptures that we made.
And yeah. Kim, you spent your career in metalworking and artistic design, decades in Miami Beach and in the Keys. How did Neptune combine your passions for marine life and the arts?
Well, actually, when I grew up, my parents had a weekend house in the Keys, so I grew up as a kid down in the Keys, and I was going to be a marine biologist or an oceanographer, you know. Well, that never came, you know, true, but because I loved it, and I was around the ocean my whole life, and so I learned a lot, and then I became a sculptor. So everything I learned as being a sculptor for the decades is what taught me how and what to do to build this structure. You know, because actually I made everything out of foam, and then I made rubber molds with fiberglass over that. And so I built the molds, and we cast the concrete, and there we were.
So, Kim, are you going to have your remains placed in this memorial?
Yes. I'm not sure yet where they're just starting the phase two, which is maybe a dozen units starting the road into the city. And I'm just waiting to see where it goes from there.
Kim Brandel, again, is the designer of the Neptune Memorial Reef. It is just off the coast of Key Biscayne. Already 1,500 cremation placements there. Room for lots more if in case you're thinking about where you're going to place your remains. How about underwater in this Atlantis that he is building? Kim Brandel, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Okay. Good day.
And again, he joined us via Skype. Well, that's the program for today. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Have a good one. We'll talk tomorrow.